Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us and to have you here, and we're all together, and that's all good. That's the good news. We've got a lot of other stuff to talk about, and we'll do so in just a moment. Let me introduce the panel to you, the group, and a reminder that you can join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, my friend. I'm just fine. I'm sitting here with my mask on, looking at you through the window so that we can communicate with each other by hand signals.
That's right.
Some of which are particularly, you know, poignant.
As always. We also welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Joe. I guess you are still number one in Alan's book.
That's right.
That's the sign I'm thinking of.
One more segment.
Joe, if I could just, could I just give a big shout out to all the poll workers, especially the poll workers that were at the Burn Volunteer Fire Station, because I voted there on Monday night. They were exceptional. I just want to say thank you to everybody who's working the polls right now.
How long did it take?
It took minutes. There was no line at all.
Really?
And they were terrific. Yep, no line at all.
That's great.
That's great. Good news. And yes, indeed, a shout out to them. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius Kelly, is with us. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great this morning. You know what's really fun about this particular morning? Fran and I are also on Zoom with each other. So we see each other. And we can make faces and all kinds of things while we're listening
also make gestures at one another. That's great.
We're Zooming.
Well, you stole my thunder, but we are very excited. We get to welcome back our good friend Fran Berman. She hasn't been on our program for almost a year. She was out in Harvard land. I'm going to read the her full title here, and then we should have a minute or two for letters, and then we'll be all set. Edward Hamilton, Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI, Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, and the Katharine Hampson Bessel Fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University. Dr. Fran Berman, how are you?
I am wonderful. How are you? I so missed you guys, and it's so great to be back. Thanks for asking.
Well, it is a delight to have you back. We missed you horribly, and we're thrilled that you're back here in town and doing great work and so many wonderful honors that have come your way, well deserved, and we congratulate you on all of that, and we're just thrilled that you get to participate in our program as well.
Put another way, you are intellectual hot stuff.
Well, thanks so much. The most important thing to know about me is I voted, and I encourage everybody else, if you haven't already voted, go do it. It is really important.
What was your experience like? Was it painless or was it tough?
Well, I did this interesting thing. I got myself an absentee ballot, and I filled it out in the privacy of my home. And then I just walked over to the Troy balloting place, and I gave it to the person. So they got it, and I'm eager for it to be counted.
So no postal service, no nothing. You just hand in. That's good.
No, yeah. I don't know. It was just when everybody was going crazy about the postal stuff, and I knew, you know, you could probably trust it, but I just wanted to make sure it got there.
Well, we are thrilled you are back. We are thrilled that you're all here. Thank you very much. So let's get started. We've got a lot to talk about. One of the things is exactly what we are talking about, and that is early voting. The surge is scrambling Election Day expectations as some states gallop toward 2016 turnout levels. After weeks of early and mail voting, at least 69 million Americans have already cast their ballots for next week's election. An historic figure that has upended expectations about Election Day and which states could decide the presidential contest. This from the Washington Post. The massive number, which includes voters who have cast ballots either in person or by mail, has stunned election officials and campaign operatives. It equals roughly half of the turnout in 2016, all but ensuring, with early voting continuing through the weekend, that the majority of ballots will be cast before Election Day for the first time in history. The overwhelming demand to vote now, which has led to long lines nationwide, reflects a widespread sense of urgency to chart the country's course over the next 4 years, despite the voting challenges posed by the coronavirus pandemic. And it puts this year's election on pace for a historic rate of participation not seen since the early 1900s. For now, the early numbers overwhelmingly favor Democrats in 16 of 19 states that provide such data. But the gap between Democratic and Republican voters has narrowed in recent days and has also done so in several battleground states. And the campaigns of President Trump and Vice President Joe Biden noted that more Republicans are expected to vote on November 3rd, Election Day, than Democrats, according to numerous polls. The question, of course, is how many more? All right. That's where we'll start. Alan, what do you think?
What a mess. You know, Joe, this is very scary. This is the first election I ever have participated in. I'm, you know, getting up there now, in which I just have the feeling that one side isn't going to play fair. And I think that side is going to be the Trump side. We already know. And what's scary is that the Supreme Court seems to be indicating that they're going to go along with it one way or another. Whatever Trump asks for, he's going to get from those folks. Elections are supposed to be state function, but, you know, they're grabbing what they can. And I'm very worried about this election, because I think the future of America lies in it because of it. If Trump wins this, I do believe that he's indicated in so many ways that we are going to become a totalitarian society, and I'll leave it at that.
All right, Bob. On that note,
you know, Joe, it's I can't say that Alan's wrong. You know, all elections are important, but this one appears to be particularly important because we're starting to talk about some of our bedrock core beliefs of this country. I was struck. I actually tried to vote on Sunday morning, believe it or not, at 8:10 in the morning down in Albany, and the line was wrapped around the polling place. And, you know, it just made me feel so good to see people who are actually taking the step to use the power that they have, that we have, in order to try to readdress or address issues that are facing us as a society. So the positive element is the number of people are voting, and, you know, you hit it right on the head. If you look at numbers coming out of Texas and Florida, I mean, they're super impressive. It gives me a little bit of pause because I'm not sure exactly how to read it. And that makes me obviously a little bit nervous. And as I've said in the past, I continue to have significant 2016 PTSD. And Alan, I think you're absolutely right that we need to be not only paranoid, but we need to be absolutely vigilant to make sure that there is no rotten business that goes on in this election.
Yeah, I
agree with Alan as well. I think that Alan's right, that I think that we can see, or we can imagine, that there's going to be some unusual stuff, you know, once the vote gets in. But I got to tell you, I really love the fact that people are really aggressively trying to vote. That this early voting surge, you know, over roughly half the votes that were even cast in the 2016 election are already cast. You're getting all kinds of new constituencies, young people and, you know, Texans and black voters, depending on the state, and new voters and all of these kinds of things that are showing up. Of course, we don't have data on everybody, and they're not collecting data on everybody. And all of this data is being analyzed for, you know, who's showing up and who's not, which will be used by the campaigns. So I agree with Alan that I think when the vote is in, we may see a lot of misbehavior and a lot of reaction from both sides. But But I do think the fact that people are turning out is terrific. And I'm excited that there are all these ways to do it.
Vera.
So I wanted to agree that two things. First of all, I do notice an uptick in terms of young people voting. On our campus at Siena, there's a lot of organization going on among the student clubs to get everybody, you know, a while ago registered as voters, and then really structure opportunities for students to participate in this election. And the participation rate is significantly up in comparison to past years. So that's a good sign. But also at the same time, this weekend, I was in the Hudson Valley in near Red Hook, New York, and all of a sudden we were caught up. We were driving through Red Hook, and all of a sudden there was this parade of flatbed trucks with big, huge flags and Trump signs coming through town, sort of these, you know, 25, 30 trucks driving through. And sort of sending a message that we are here, we are present, we're going to be vigilant about what you lefties do. So it was a very intimidating kind of experience to see, you know, the way they were behaving and gesturing. So I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of counter experience. I was feeling pretty confident knowing that a lot of young people are stepping up and voting and proud of their participation in the democratic system. Yet at the same time, you also notice people that are ferociously Trumpian organize and send messages to population groups that they are present and they will be pushing back. So I think the motivation is very strong on both sides, actually.
When you look at that, the parades and the rallies, the trucks, all that kind of thing, was that near polling places?
Yes. Oh, I mean, it's always these things happen near town centers. So
yeah.
It's near libraries. Yeah. It's near public squares. You know, so there is the point to send this message that we are present, right?
We have.
And then I wanted to tell you about another. Yeah, I wanted to tell you about another experience. Well, not experience. A friend of mine had, a faculty member lives in Missouri, and he went to Walmart to buy something, and he noticed that the ammo section was entirely emptied out.
Yeah, that's throughout the country. Yeah, that's throughout the country. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was reporting that he was talking to people working at Walmart in the cashier section and commenting on the fact that the ammo was sold out, and the cashier said, "Yes, finally, people are waking up." In other words, they're expecting to have to defend their rights to carry arms, and you know, those kinds of debates must be going on in that part of the country. So they're expecting some kind of a fallout
again, we're seeing that throughout the country. Even I know in Warren, Washington, Saratoga County, in the North Country, and around here, that there are reports of guns and ammo being sold out. Bob, let me talk to you for a moment about the idea of voter intimidation, of these kinds of things, of how real that is. We've been hearing a lot of stories out of Philadelphia, but of course it impacts other parts of the world as well.
Yeah, no, I think that we need to be extra vigilant, because I do believe both voter suppression and intimidation is going to be part of the playbook. What's interesting, though, is that if you start to look at the number of votes that are cast, I'm starting to wonder how effective that's going to be. Particularly, you know, I heard the segment on NPR, and I'm seeing it on some other news cycles, that anticipating a larger Republican turnout on Election Day rather than pre-voting, which means that they, in some respects, the Trump people might be intimidating their own potential voters. There are a couple elements that I just want to remind everybody. If you are not feeling safe, alert the authorities. I mean, you have every right to vote. You have every right to have access to an election location. Your voice is no less important than anybody else. Do not let bullies intimidate you. And you know, we have lived under this mass bullying for 4 years, and this is when we all need to stand up and say no to it. I also think it's interesting, if I could just go back to one point that was made earlier about student voting. I do wonder, and I sort of personally feel that with COVID having so many students that are actually home rather than on campus, that's going to make it actually easier for students to vote sometimes when they're away from home. And I do think that's going to have a potential impact on the election. And Joe, like I've been saying, I still hold to the belief that the election is not going to only go to Biden and the Senate's going to flip. It's going to flip big. That I think the level of fed upness with that this country has is going to be shown by this turnout.
Especially
you
when
know,
you
the
see-
interesting thing about oh, I'm sorry, Alan, go on.
No, go please. Go ahead.
The interesting thing to me is that, of course, we're hearing about the turnouts, but it's not just the levels. You know, those levels are being connected with demographic data. And that demographic data is being used very cleverly by both campaigns in their get-out-the-vote strategies. So I was talking to a friend in Seattle the other day, and she would say, I have to get off the phone. I have like a 3-hour stint where I'm calling people in Wisconsin and encouraging them to make a plan for voting, which is what the experts say. It's not just intending to vote. It's making a plan for vote. And I said, you know, is there anybody left in the U.S. who actually doesn't know who they're going to vote for? And she said, this is not about the undecideds, whoever they may be. This is about the people that intend to vote for, you know, our candidate, which was Biden, and getting them out to vote and making sure that they go to the polls. So it's interesting, you know, for me as a data scientist that, you know, as you sort of collect all this stuff, it's really being used very pragmatically and practically to try to up the chances of each campaign to get their voters out there.
We've got about 30 seconds. Did you want to say anything else?
No, I think the COVID thing is so extraordinary that people are really taking a look at this. People are dropping dead. People are getting this at huge numbers. It's on the rise, and it has got to be killing Trump. It's got to be.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our panel. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return after this short break. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Bob Griffin, Vera Karius-Kelly, and the return of Fran Berman. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We get letters. I have a lot of them, and one like this from John, who says, my stress levels are really high waiting for this election to be over. But then I have dread about what Trump is going to do when hopefully he loses. Frying pan into the fire. This guy reminds me of a cross between the showman Emperor Nero and Mussolini. His sickness is also in 30% of our population. How does one process this emotional decay in our society?
Good letter. Jump on that. Yeah, but this is going to be a huge issue for both the nation and our communities, the issue of our mental health. And it's not just the election, it's COVID, it's the economy. This is, in my estimation, probably one of the most significant looming crises in this country. And we're going to have to spend a lot more resources and a lot more time addressing this problem. But, you know, like the letter writer, and I'd be interested in what the other panelists say, I'm feeling the same thing. I mean, I read polls and I get a knot in my gut, yeah. You know, thinking, oh God, is that right? Is this happening again? And I know, like the Rasmussen's polls, that they're biased, but at the same time, I'm looking at them going, oh my goodness. So, you know, letter writer, I'm with you.
You know what I didn't like about the letter? You know, the assumption, and it's a very good letter, by the way, but what I didn't really, what worries me is the idea that Trump will lose. This guy isn't, what does he do when he loses? This guy is not going to lose, according to him. He's going to use his followers on the Supreme Court. He's going to use whatever he can do with the Postal Service and has and all the rest of it. He's going to claim, because he's a big lying liar, that he's going to claim that he didn't lose. You know that's the case.
Well,
yeah, Alan, I mean, I think no matter what, and this is why I continue to push, you know, everybody needs to vote, but it's going to be a big win. I'd love to see, you know, over 300 electoral college of votes for Biden. I mean, we need to send a clear message to the political class of what is acceptable and what's not.
But with everything that you,
yeah, I mean,
you go ahead, please. Yeah,
Vera.
Yeah. So I just was thinking about this issue as well. It is a period of high stress, and the reason why we're also so stressed is that we not only need to win, but we need to win overwhelmingly to send the message that no you know, sort of untoward activities should be happening, and we are able to watch what this administration will do after the election, right? So, I mean, that is why many of us feel high levels of anxiety, because we believe that we can anticipate potential outbursts of anger and violence in some locations, attempts to manipulate the data, or simply send messages that we can trust in our democratic system. And that has such long-lasting consequences for this country and its populations, and that is what gives us such anxiety, I think.
So many of the letters.
Go ahead, friend. Oh, sorry.
No, you're fine.
It's such a weird thing when I can't see you.
I know.
And I apologize when I interrupt. I mean, I agree with the letter writer, and the election is, you know, the frosting on the cake. I mean, there is so much anxiety from all of the lifestyle changes, from the pandemic, from the many, many people who have been sick themselves or known people who, you know, have been sick or died, and the worries, from the problems of not being able to see one's family members and one's friends, from the election, from the protests. We're really coming to terms with so much about the fabric of our society that both doesn't work and you know, we're trying to make work. So I agree, and I also agree with, you know, Alan and Vera and others that, you know, we're likely to see a lot of acting out after that. We're going to see, you know, on each side, you know, widespread depression, maybe civil unrest. And in some sense, we need to be prepared. You know, we each are developing kind of our own coping strategies for getting through this time, which is such an unusual and really poignant and tragic time. And, you know, I just would encourage the letter writer and, like, all of us to, you know, really be prepared for drama, and to, you know, try to figure out, you know, what can we do to keep ourselves healthy and safe and to participate as we like.
It's interesting because so many of the letters that we get today, I mean, obviously we've been talking about it, so they do bring them in. But so many of the letters that we have today have to do with that fear and what's going to happen next, and trying to mull those questions over. John writes to us and says, Alan said that America could become a totalitarian society if Trump is reelected. What would a totalitarian society look like under Trump? concentration camps, burning books, mass murders. When I think of totalitarianism, I think of Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia.
Well, I'll take a crack at it. I think totalitarian means to me that one person is in charge and that the democratic system is dismissed. I think that's what's going to happen. I have no doubt that when Trump's niece said, I think last week, I just read it, that he means what he says. Forget about, he doesn't mean that. Oh, he's just kidding. He's not. He means what he says. And you know, when I think of huge numbers of people, let's say it's as overwhelming as Bob and Vera and Fran say it should be, first of all, the polls are indicating, you know, it's where it's always been in America. But if it is overwhelming, it won't stop him for a single minute. It hasn't stopped any other major dictator in the history of the world from making hay out of whatever they want to make it out of. So, you know, do I think that Trump will do everything in his power, including using those toadies on the Supreme Court that he's got there now to obviate people's right to vote? That's disgusting.
Jim, yeah,
if I could jump in, Joe?
Yeah, sure.
But just a couple quick comments. One, you know, I think when you start to see being a tool for the president or the leader rather than the people, that's certainly one of the indicators. You know, the use of secret police, the idea that you could be walking down the street in a van with people who don't identify either their name or their branch of government can jump out and grab you. The idea that the law is manipulated to impact resistance or the so-called people who are, quote, enemies of the president, not violators of the true law, and frankly we're seeing certain elements of this. If you think about how federal law enforcement has been misused, if you look at the pressure the president is putting on the attorney general and the FBI to be his attack dog, his personal attack dogs rather than true mechanisms of justice. There's a lot that we need to be concerned about, and the damage that we've done to both our judiciary and we've continued to do to our executive branch government agencies is going to be something that's going to be, frankly, it's going to take generation plus to clean up.
Mm.
But also, I think it is less visible issues that we should worry about. For example, the Trump administration just removed the chief scientist, I think, from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, right? So yeah. Our chief scientists are being sidelined and removed from leadership positions even after decades of service and excellent commitment to the best scientific data we have available worldwide. And now these people are being removed because they are critiquing or they are speaking about matters that this administration doesn't want to discuss. And now these chief scientists are being replaced by yes men who are basically advancing this administration's agenda for climate change or scientific research. And now we pretty soon are going to live in a world where we don't trust any of our data coming to inform our research or our knowledge about what is happening around us. And I think that is one of the less visible and just as scary developments in this country, at least to me.
But Vera, that's been happening for a while. I mean, Trump has very successfully replaced science with loyalty. And you look at all of the institutions that would provide evidence that would help us work through the challenges that we have, including COVID. Look at the CDC, look at the EPA, now look at NOAA. Look at the deprioritization of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing all of that data and all of that evidence that has helped us make smart and strategic decisions over the years through all administrations. And, you know, they just don't count anymore unless they're saying something that Trump happens to like.
We have a question.
Yeah.
We have a question for Fran from John, who says, curious as to what the panel, especially Fran, thinks of the accuracy of polling data in the face of this abnormal surge of early voting. In what ways could the weighting be off?
Oh, thanks, John. I just went over that in my class. It's like such a pleasure to talk about it again. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting when you look at the election models and the polling data, and then you ask yourself, you know, what's right? And so there's all kinds of reasons things can be wrong. So, for example, in previous elections, people polled people and they asked them questions and they called them up on their landlines. And if you think about who has a landline anymore, it's not a representative sample. It certainly is not a representative sample of younger demographics. If they, you know, so depending on like who you choose to ask the question, you can get different answers, even if they're not lying. And then sometimes people do lie. And so in the last election, they were really worried about people who wanted to vote for Trump for the first time, not admitting to that, but doing that. So they figured out all kinds of other questions to do that. So, you know, and I could go on and on, but the bottom line is your mileage kind of varies. You know, each of these polls, you know, has different kind of weaknesses in terms of how they collect the data, who they collect the data from. And then, of course, the data just tells people who intend to vote. It doesn't say who actually voted, because that's in the future. That being said, 538 and The Economist and some of these other election models try to average out things that they see in lots of different polls. And so, you know, that tends to get you a little closer to ground truth, because now you're looking at a bunch of different polls which have a bunch of different weaknesses, sometimes different weaknesses, and then they might give you the same trend. From what I'm looking at, the trend, the polls favor Biden, but they don't think it's a slam dunk. And you know, whether it is or not, will be left to see. But just know, anytime you're collecting data, your mileage is going to vary as to, like, the integrity of that data. And, you know, no data set is 100% perfect.
Alan?
And Joe, if last week, Alan, you did a terrific interview with Siena College.
Yep.
in their polling. That I had a nerdgasm listening to that. That was an excellent explanation of polling and what's being done to try to deal with some of the issues that Fran just raised. So I apologize for not remembering who you interviewed, but that was I just pointed.
He was
that
the head of the Siena poll.
That was a great interview.
He was the head of the Siena poll. Let me just say that all of us, I think, are probably addicted to 538, right? And we go on and we look, and Fran has been prescient about talking about this. We go on and we look at all of the differences. Now, some of them are basically polling prostitutes, meaning that we know who they are. And some are indicated as Republican or Democratic. But, you know, there are real differences in what these polls are coming up with and how they have weighted, EIGHT, how they have weighted their samples. And they are the Siena, wonderful Siena pollster was telling me that the reason that it was wrong, people were wrong the last time, is they hadn't given non-college educated whites enough of a weight. In the thing. And Fran, I wonder if you'd go to that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really interesting to listen to the experts on this, because they have to make choices. So if you think about it, if you're a pollster, you can't poll everybody in the United States. You just can't do it, even if you could reach them. So you have to decide what a representative sample is. And, you know, they've made different choices about it. I mean, the psychographic analysis for the data that I was talking about a little bit ago. I mean, they're taking all of the data they can and taking all of the different categories people can be in and then trying to kind of shuffle them around to do something that's representative. But they make choices. And the other thing that's super interesting is, you know, where do they get the data from? And some of the data is publicly available, and the campaigns buy some of the data. So these are data brokers that are happening behind our backs, like they do for everything else, including the things you buy on Amazon. And so they buy some of the data, so then they have to make choices about which information they need to buy in order to get the most accurate count. And as you can tell, there's a lot of science in this, but there's a lot of art in this, too. You know, it's like your doctor trying to figure out what disease you have. They have some information and they have some experience, and they combine them both to try to make, you know, the best and most authentic decision they can. But, you know, it's both art and science.
We're late for a break. Let's do that. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. Many more letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We've been talking about polling. Alan Chartok, Bob Griffin, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Fran Berman with us. Fran, I have a question about when different news organizations say that they are taking a poll, it is a collection. They're basically putting all the polls together. And giving you an average of the polls, a polling average. So to what Alan was saying before about, and even what you were saying as well, that when you have certain organizations, one of the things that, as Alan was talking about, one of the things about 538 that I like is that they grade the polling institutions. Yeah. They grade them and we'll give, some get a D, some get an F, some get an A, some get an A plus, A minus, whatever. So when you put all of those together, isn't that weighted too? I mean, that doesn't seem overly accurate to me. If you know that there's a polling institution going into that mix that is probably off by 10 points.
Yeah, I mean that's really true. And I think there's a couple of different ways to do it. And I can't speak to, you know, 538 or any specific thing because I don't know the approach they take. But here's the general approach. General approaches they might take. One approach they might take is just to grade the one, you know, grade them. And it may be that they look at it by sort of slicing it up. What do the A polls say? What do the B polls say? What do the F polls say? And then, you know, making some sort of weighted average for that. Another thing they might do is they might, you know, I mean, you don't just sort of look at everybody and then like take the average of that, because that will give you a lot of junk data, right? Garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
And so so what they probably do is find some way of both weighting the polls and trying to figure it out. So then comes the question is like, how do you weight a poll? And one thing you can do is you can weight it by comparing it to, you know, comparing its prediction to what actually happened, right? Or comparing its prediction to what you thought A polls might do. And so, you know, they need to have some sort of criteria for trying to figure out if a poll is bad or good, other than, you know, I don't know, it was like run by Fran Berman or run by Trump's brother-in-law or something like that. So they need to have some sort of criteria for that. But then probably what they do is take the polls that are most legitimate and give them the most weight, I would imagine.
But Joe, when you think about polls, this is, I think, the most important point. Polls don't vote. Okay, lawn signs don't vote, flags don't vote. That what people got to remember is that, you know, you can take a look at them, but what really makes a difference is you going to vote. That's what really counts. That's what counts at the end of the day.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, one of the things that also scares me, and I mean really scares me, is just because. We saw what happened in 2016, and so just two large media organizations and how they're doing it differently. But so the New York Times has an interactive graphic up that said the battleground states Biden and Trump need to win 270. So they give Biden 212 electoral college votes. They give Trump 125. And so this is according to Cook Political Report ratings to potential outcomes. So they have already put 212 into the Biden column. They have put 125 into the Trump column. I find that interesting. I use it a lot. What is scaring me is that CNN now has one out, and they already have Biden at 290. Now, I don't know. First of all, is that responsible? Second of all, to Bob's point, yes, polls don't vote. So, but the fact that even because they're counting Pennsylvania, they're counting Wisconsin, they're counting Michigan, they're counting Minnesota, those seem that seems really to be putting the cart before the horse. But overall, it just seems dangerous for getting the word out for people to do exactly what we're talking about, which is to vote.
Well, and the last election was really a cautionary tale because the models predicted that it would be, you know, very strong win for Hillary Clinton, and it wasn't. Well, I mean, that she got the popular vote, but it wasn't an electoral college vote. And so, you know, in and above the accuracy of all of this stuff and, you know, the goodness or badness of the predictions is the ethics of it. You know, I mean, this is the reason that, you know, we don't declare a winner before the polls are closed on election day. And, you know, so in some sense, this is kind of, if you squint, this is kind of a version of declaring a winner before everybody's, you know, gone and voted. And is that really an ethical thing?
You know, I love CNN and I watch it all day long. And frankly, I'm not fooling myself. I think they've committed to getting Trump out of there. And we do have a bandwagon effect in this country. I think they know it. You know, if somebody thinks they want to, Americans want to be on the winning side quite often. So I think CNN has an agenda. I think Fox has an agenda. No question. I love CNN's agenda, but I'm not surprised to hear this.
So I wanted to say something else and also to Fran's point. I know a lot of people who have completely stopped watching any TV, and young people are not, for them, TV is not really a reference point in the first place. So when you mention TV, they look at you blankly and say they haven't, you know, watched any TV in years. And I have a lot of friends who have completely stopped paying any attention to anything that either Fox or CNN report. So I really think that we are overestimating sometimes the power and influence of television reporting like that for a significant and growing segment of the population. And I think I just wanted to say that that is something I think we will see increasing in the coming years because of a lack of trust and confidence in the agendas hidden in some of those, you know, in some of those leadership positions of these television shows and reports and just in general media messages.
Well, good for them if they can do it. I can't stay away from it. I've got to be on it every time. I'm watching everything. I'm looking at everything. I've got every notification. If a voter dies in Minnesota, I get an alert on my phone, so the numbers may have changed. I think there's so much at stake at the election that people, as Alan was saying, you know, you're addicted to CNN, you're addicted to other news sources because you want to find out what's happening, and whether that be an interactive map on the internet or through television coverage. I mean, it seems to me we started this conversation a moment ago or an hour ago by talking about just what a hellish couple of days this is going to be because we're all trying to figure out what it's going to be like, and we know it's not going to be over on November 4th when we wake up.
So for the news junkies, it's particularly difficult to survive the next week. I think I agree. That is terribly stressful.
Yes. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters. We have more topics. We have a wonderful panel. We'll do. We'll mix all of those together when we come back right after this. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel of discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Bob Griffin, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Fran Berman making up the panel this morning. A lot of letters from folks. I want to go to as many of those as possible because they're all really good. Or most of them, anyway. So, Linda says, dearest panel, please talk to us about Justice Kavanaugh's opinion about mail ballots yesterday. Hearing him use Trump's language is scaring me to death. Alan.
And well, it should. Because basically, he's saying, you know, he got me appointed, he appointed me, and whatever he wants, that's what I'm going to give him. It's disgusting.
Scary. Bob?
Yeah, he definitely showed his true colors. My initial reaction is, I mean, everybody should sort of chip in and just send beer to Kavanaugh's house because he likes that. I think he was trying to foreshadow a position that he would like the court to take on Election Day. And I think his thinking is so faulty. I mean, we count them for a reason. So we should be paying attention to what Kavanaugh is saying.
Absolutely.
We go to William. This is the difference between the roundtable and Fox News is that the panel is a platform where their anti-Trump point of view is affirmed and never challenged. Fox News has a host of liberal pundits such as Juan Williams, Leslie Marshall, Richard Fowler, and Donna Brazile. So we on the right are well acquainted with arguments by the left. By ignoring half of the country who supports the president, you are setting up your audience for a repeat of 2016.
What?
Yeah, well, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to send a letter in.
Jim says...
No, can I comment on that?
Of course.
Because this is something that's really bugged me about the way we handle all of this stuff, which is I think there are legitimate opinions all throughout America, you know, no matter who you voted for. And I think that what I kind of see is sort of the exact same thing, which is it's not true that everybody who voted differently than you is like a bad person or has an illegitimate point of view. And it's also not true that everybody on your side has a great opinion about stuff. And, you know, I agree with the writer that this polarization is not productive. And, you know, I think the more we can kind of get to issues and the nuances of the problems in those issues, which I know is really difficult in a polarized environment, you know, the better it will be. But, you know, we're all Americans here, and I don't like the polarization myself.
Daniel says to those...
I wanted to also say that as a European, I always laugh about this idea that there are two positions, because I think there are, as Fran says, so many nuances. And it actually would be a good thing if this country had a multi-party system where people could actually articulate nuanced, intelligent positions rather than having to line up between one or the other option. I find the U.S. system mysterious in that way, that you have to fall in line in certain ways rather than, you know, having the opportunity to really... you know, develop specific positions related to specific policies. So to me, polarization along two parties seems very counterproductive to democracy.
We are nothing if not mysterious. Yes, Alan.
Well, let me just say, I think personally, I think so highly of both Vera and Fran, but I have to say, I think...
I know what's coming, Alan.
Yeah, you do. I think this country is the greatest danger it's ever been in. I think that it's not polarizing between people on either side. It's a guy who basically is showing his totalitarian fascist, side. And how in the world can we say, oh, it's just... both sides are polarized. No, there really is. I mean, would you have said that about Hitler? Would you have said that about Mao? The fact of the matter is that this guy is definable and therefore and scary, and we ought to be taking him very, very seriously in terms of what's going to happen to the U.S. and its constitution.
You know, in some sense, I don't disagree with that, Alan, from my own point of view. But the scary thing to me is that the people I know and love who voted differently than I did in this election feel the same way. And, you know, I think it's just a really difficult, challenging thing. If you really feel like, you know, we're going to hell and everybody, you know, on your side is okay and everybody not on the other side is okay. And, you know, just a personal thing in the too much information category, I had this huge fight with my brother, who is a good dude. And
Invite him to Thanksgiving.
Yeah, going differently than I did. And I bet we're not the only family in which this happened. And I just think this is, you know, causing, you know, real problems in the fabric of our society and, you know, our inability to be able to really discuss this at depth and have tolerance for one another's view. And I worry about that a ton.
Daniel writes and says, to those who excuse Trump's statements by claiming he doesn't mean what he says, how are the masses and the world at large supposed to differentiate between what he means and doesn't mean? Try raising your children with that philosophy.
Now, the niece, Joe, the niece said he means what he says. I mean, that's exactly what people know about him who know him. This isn't the guy who doesn't mean what he says. He means it.
Jim writes, yeah. In light of the New York State Troopers Union endorsement of Trump, can we count on them to protect voters against the Trumpers?
Oh, yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think that most officers can clearly separate themselves from the position of their union leadership. New York State Police is a tremendous organization, high ethical standards. I actually have no concern at all there.
We go back to the letters and go to John that says, it seems likely that any unusual methods of voting will be disputed. So why are so many Democrats voting by mail or pre-voting? Mm. The Republicans are less likely to be doing this. We are setting ourselves up for disputes.
Good point. You know, I voted by mail, and I tell you, I have worried about it ever since, based on the fact that, and I voted very early, so we know it got there. The idea, though, is really awful that he's going to try to disqualify mail voting. You know he is.
Bob?
And Joe, I pre-voted simply because I was just concerned about making sure that I could get to cast my ballot. You know, you start to think about potential for bad weather. You start to think about potential for something going on at work, something going on at home. I wanted to make sure that my vote was there. That's why I voted early. And I also wanted to vote early in a way that it would be counted the day of, because I don't want to give anybody this potential seam of, well, the initial numbers said that I won, you know, I wanted to be part of the loud chorus about where the country is going. And there's a lot of, you know, we haven't talked yet about some of the other variables that could affect Tuesday. You know, there's a hurricane coming to Louisiana. The COVID case numbers are enormous. I mean, we've seen a 39% increase in COVID cases in the last 2 weeks, 983 deaths last night. I mean, so you start to think about all of these variables that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I thought it was prudent to take the time and vote when I did.
We go,
you know,
back. Go ahead.
Again, let me make a comment about being European. It is very normal in many states in this union, as well as in many countries, to actually vote by mail, and has been for a long time, for a decade or more. I mean, we have to modernize. We have to sort of add options to people to participate in this election and other elections. We shouldn't just stick by something because we have always done it that way, when there are alternative ways, better ways, or multiple ways to allow people to engage in their civic duties.
And even if you don't vote by mail, I really love the idea that there's, you know, kind of a long on-ramp for pre-voting.
Yeah.
So you can go when it's convenient, or when you don't have to work, or when it's less crowded, or... Mm-hmm. You know, I think Bob is right in terms of, you know, you never know what's going to happen election day. And for the most part, I've always gone on election day because there's a certain excitement. And I got to tell you, the saddest part about voting this time was no little sticker. I love those little
You didn't
stickers.
Get a sticker?
I didn't get a sticker.
Oh.
But, yeah, please feel free to give me an extra sticker if there is one. But But yeah, and there is something exciting about going to the polls and finding your names and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I love the fact that this can accommodate people's schedules, because I think that's really important.
We got this from Doug, who says, I'm nervous that unrest in Philadelphia over the most recent police shootings might reduce people coming out to vote in Philadelphia, which could throw the election in Pennsylvania and thus the Electoral College. I'm also concerned that the Democratic edge for victory lies in mail-in ballots, which might not arrive on time due to Trump's sabotage of the Postal Service and or be thrown out on trumped-up technicalities.
You know, that's an interesting point, Joe. In Massachusetts, I presume, since Roselle and I got ballots in the mail, mail-in ballots, that there are a lot of states that are doing that. And I would hate to think that the idea that states were approving of this and basically making it happen, and that the president was looking askance at it and asking his, and I mean his, Supreme Court to find it invalid one way or another. For example, when the votes arrived, if they arrived a day later, but they were postmarked earlier, too bad, tough noogies.
Hey, Alan, is it ever the case that, imagine that you do this incorrectly, you don't use the little envelope or you don't sign the right thing, that somebody like actually sends you something and says your ballot's invalid. Here's a different, we threw it away, here's a different ballot, you know, make sure you do this. Does anybody ever do that?
What do you mean? Do you mean the senders do it, or do the receivers do it?
The receiver, yeah. Do they send you a thing back and say, you did it wrong, do it again?
You know, I've read a lot about this stuff. I don't know. I have no idea. And for me to make an incorrect statement, Fran, would be really wrong of me.
Hold yourself to a higher standard than the rest of us.
At least than the president.
All right, let's go to this letter from Matt, who says, I saw the same caravan that Vera saw and completely agree about the intimidation factor. Not only are they driving through with huge flags, two of the trucks were equipped with train horns, and they continually blow them at people trying to just enjoy their weekend in Rhinebeck. Linda says, when you say the number of Republican voters is catching up with Democratic voters, does that mean that those Republicans are Trump voters or possibly Lincoln Project Republicans voting for Biden? I don't know that we ever said that Republican voters were catching up, right?
Well, I think you made an intimation in the beginning, Joe, that it was tightening.
I think we were reading about the number, the fact that I remember reading was the number of early voting is favoring Democrats.
Oh,
of the 12 states, I think, that give out that information.
Yes, that is what you said, and thank you for that.
So I don't know. Well.
Well, the point really is nobody should take this. Nobody.
Well, you know the party affiliation, but you can't know what people voted unless they tell you. So that's not part of the data.
Well, Fran, you're the data specialist, but I think one can assume, based on the fact that 90% or a little less than that now support the president and not the Lincoln Project, that we know where most of those folks stand when we see a greater turnout.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the right, that people are voting along party lines is exactly the right assumption. But they don't actually have the data. If I say, you know, I'm a Democrat or Republican or Green Party or whatever, they don't actually know that I voted for the candidate of my party,
right,
unless I tell them.
We go to Chris, who says... this is for you, Alan. Please, can you explain the process if the assigned Electoral College votes are contested? The House will vote one bite per state in early January.
One vote per state.
Will this House be House? There are words missing from this letter, but
it doesn't matter. But
I get the point.
The Republicans will win under those circumstances. Because, you know, it's one vote per state, not in terms of how many Electoral College votes you have. The Republicans would win, so it better not get there.
Do you believe, says Brian, that national news TV election night coverage will attempt to declare a winner, even though a significant number of absentee ballots will not have to be counted yet?
The answer
That's
is
a really good question, right? Because we fear that because, you know,
certain stations want to be leading in their analysis, and they're competing with each other over market share. So they may make a mistake, although they have made a mistake in the past, so they could be a little more cautious. But that is certainly something to pay attention to, because I, at this point, personally would not necessarily believe somebody who makes an early call on that.
You know, there are a lot of assumptions about what's going to happen here. One of those assumptions is that the Republicans will come out in strength and vote the day of the election. That's an assumption, right, Fran? In terms of logic, that's the assumption. That's
the assumption that we're reading about. Yeah.
And I suggest the assumption could be wrong.
It could be wrong, Alan. You know, it could be wrong because of COVID numbers going up. It could be wrong if the weather is terrible in certain parts of the country. It could be wrong if there are transportation breakdowns or something else. That
a lot of reasons.
Or perhaps people are not as motivated because they feel frustrated by something that happens just days before the election. You're right.
Been frustrated for the past four years.
If you're a Republican, if you're a young person, and we know that in any presidential election, about half the people vote. In this presidential election, which we see record turnout, the assumption is about 60%. That means 40% who are eligible to vote are not going to do it. And I suggest what's going to happen is that an awful lot of people who are not motivated to vote. Joe, you told a terrific story yesterday on the roundtable in which you said that 23 out of 25 students said they'd already voted.
Yeah.
David Gustina, when asked the same question, said he was getting some of the usual stuff back. It doesn't matter who wins, this kind of thing. But I have a feeling that some of the unvoting young population are going to turn out in record numbers on the day of the election. And this assumption that the Republicans take the vote on the day of the election is just wrong.
Hmm.
Well, the other interesting thing is, if you think about election night coverage, you know, most of us are not watching C-SPAN, right? Which, you know, tries to sort of all the facts of the facts. And so, you know, the networks or, you know, whoever you're watching is trying to make this entertaining. And so they're, you know, backed up by as much election integrity as they're, you know, willing to be backed up. They're in the entertainment business.
But they don't want to be wrong, Fran.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But my guess is they're going to try to, kind of wiggle around and make it as predictive and entertaining as they can within reason.
Bob,
a little drama and they're going to use.
Go ahead, Bob.
and you're going to start to see breakdowns almost at a ridiculous level. Like this neighborhood in this some county in Wisconsin voted this way. One of the things that I would suggest people think about is a couple of things. One is, you know, a lot of TVs, you can split the screen. A lot of folks have both a TV and a computer or a phone. Have multiple sources. Just to be able to for your own edification, see how different news feeds and numbers are coming in. I know some folks are doing virtual watch parties where they're actually dividing different media sources so they can combine it. It's going to be a long night, and you know they want to keep viewers, so the stations are going to try to be as provocative as they possibly can within certain limits, because otherwise, you know, let's be really honest, it's a pretty boring process waiting for people to count votes. I mean, it's like watching paint dry, so there's going to be an interesting night.
Yeah.
In the morning. And when we come in next week, Joe, I know it's we're not going to be getting much sleep. So please bear with us next week because we're going to be really punchy.
We'll all be with you there. Yeah, we'll all be punchy and we'll do our best. We have a few moments before we go to a break at the bottom of the hour. Leona says, of course, no matter how big the blue wave proves to be, Trump will say he won. This is the man who, while faced with the photographic evidence to the contrary, continues to say his inauguration crowds were larger than Obama's. This is the man who says he has been successful at combating COVID-19 despite the dramatically increasing numbers. Truth doesn't matter in his playbook. Because of the enablers of McConnell and the Senate Republicans, there are no brakes on this runaway train. I'm terrified. Getting a lot of "I'm terrified" this morning. Lisa says, can the panel please explain the psychology of single-issue voters? My husband and I are perplexed. Okay, so the person who goes out and says, I'm voting on guns, or I'm voting on abortion, or I'm voting on health care. Alan, can you tell us about the psychology of single-issue voters?
Maybe. I mean, maybe. I have a feeling a lot of the people who say, I'm only voting because of that, really have an orientation towards one side or the other. I'm not buying it, to be honest with you.
We go to Harry, who says, for all the originalists on the Supreme Court, how long did it take to count ballots in the 1790s?
Good question.
John says...
Well, actually, it didn't take all that long because only white male landowners could vote. So, I mean, if you think about the population, it's pretty thin.
Good point. Debbie says...
It was all centralized, right? Yes.
Vera is right that our two-party system is a disaster. It means any third-party candidate disrupts the election by taking votes away from the major party candidates, and valuable ideas cannot find a voice. Primaries head to the extremes, and then candidates have to move to the middle to win the general elections.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Joe Biden has been in the middle for a long time. And I think that's why he won the primaries, to tell you the truth. Because I think people got it, that they needed a centrist candidate in order to defeat the Republicans. And I think that's what happened.
Yes, you're right, Alan. But I just wanted to say that a lot of general voters also feel frustrated by that process, because often there's this sort of, you know, a certain wing of the party talking about something, and then there's a movement towards the center. There aren't really so many different positions clearly laid out. And I know among young people, this was often really frustrating, because they said, well, you know, Biden is better than nothing, or better than the alternative, but I don't really love everything he talks about and how he talks about agendas that I personally care about. So that is essential in terms of motivating people to really engage in the process of shaping their own visions for how America should be in their own communities, in their own regions, overall. And I think that is deeply frustrating to a lot of voters.
We have to, pause.
Real quickly.
No.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry,
you don't even have time for it real quickly. I got to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. Last call with the roundtable. Roundtable at WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Last call here on the panel section. We have Alan Chartok, Bob Griffin, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Fran Berman. So let's go to some new topics. We go to this one, which we just heard was the top story was the top story for BBC. That was what I was trying to say. Trump allies are amping up fight over tech's legal shield before election, although both Biden and Trump are against this. In September, the White House nominated a lawyer to be a commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission. One line in his resume, aiding the administration's push to limit an important legal shield for Silicon Valley companies. That same month, the Justice Department sent Congress a detailed proposal for how to change the law behind that legal shield. And today, lawmakers are confronting the chief executives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter. The topic of discussion, whether that law enables bad behavior from the companies. The Trump administration and its allies have fanned out widely in Washington in recent months to attack the law, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. The law is considered sacred by social media platforms like Facebook, Google, and Twitter because it protects them from liability for content posted by their users. Increasingly, the law is criticized by politicians of both parties. Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee for president, has called for it to be revoked, saying it allows the companies to shirk responsibility over what appears on their sites. Fran Berman, help us make sense of this.
This is a little hard to understand if you don't know the details, but the details are really important to all of us. So first of all, what is this legal shield? And this is Section 230 of something called the Communications Decency Act. And the really key part of it is, and I quote, no provider or user of an interactive computer service, Twitter, Google, Facebook, whatever, shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So that means this is sort of a protection for social media platforms. And the heart of it is, are they a platform? You know, do you just use them to say what you want? And their responsibility is as the person who provides the infrastructure. Or are they a publisher, which means they do content moderation? And there's a real difference under the law. So Trump doesn't like this because he thinks that companies have hid behind this kind of designation of platform and provider to suppress conservative views. He thinks they're giving conservatives a bad deal and they're getting rid of conservative content unduly. Biden doesn't like it because he thinks this legal shield should be revoked because it allows the companies to shirk their responsibilities because indeed they are content moderation. Now, the last thing to understand about this has been sort of a giant challenge and a giant area of discussion because if you're a big company, if you're Facebook or you're Twitter or something like that, and you want to be a platform, you're already moderating content. You have to moderate hate speech, for example, because that's illegal. So the first thing you have to do is decide what is hate speech, which is not always easy. You know, I could say, you know, Vera hates me and, you know, she has a perfect right to say that. But it's not like saying, you know, Fran Berman should be killed, which she doesn't, you know, because, you know, she has whatever views, which she doesn't have a right to say. So, and then from the company's point of view, they are doing more content moderation. You know, Twitter just, there was a big deal about Twitter saying that something that Trump said was misinformation and tagging it as such.
Right.
But it's kind of a mess for everybody. It's a mess legally, because it's not clear what these, you know, what these companies actually are, how to treat them under law. It's a mess for users who don't know what to believe. And it's a mess for the companies who, you know, no matter who you have working for you, it's really hard to sort of figure out, you know, what's information, what's misinformation, what's right, what's wrong, and what is in there. So this is, I think we're likely to see a lot of stuff around this. Privacy gets in there too, and it's messy.
Bob, any thoughts on this?
I think it's always dangerous when the government starts to try to put parameters around free speech. And I really urge people, when you're thinking about this situation, that you realize that once you start losing or controlling speech, controlling information, that free slide. So I think there's an awful lot at play. That the difference between the platform versus the publisher, you know, there's also a cynical side of me that says that if somebody can bug both the Trump administration and the potential Biden administration at the same time, they're probably doing something right. But that's a more cynical view. We haven't, as a nation, really got our arms wrapped around the issue of this sort of new modern social media information platforms. And I think there's an awful lot of work that's going to have to be done in this area. But I go back to my initial point, Joe. Once you start to control speech, it's a slippery slope.
Alan?
So I wanted to say something
because
I wanted to bring it to the international level. What once was the radio used for to call people to kill, their neighbors in the Rwandan genocide is now what right. Facebook and other social media sites do. Namely, we know the first so-called Facebook genocide was the attack on the Rohingya Muslim minority in Burma, in Myanmar. So it is extremely dangerous to not modify and monitor for governments to hold accountable those companies that actually allow genocidal murderers to call on, or to use information to manipulate fears, ethno-religious fears, and other sort of hostile messages. So to me, it is actually essential to begin to really monitor what is happening and put some parameters around these companies. They can't just simply benefit from social media sites and not be held responsible for efforts to hijack those vehicles by others. So for me, I guess I'm on the opposite side of Bob a little bit in terms of on a global level, I believe social media have had a very dangerous influence.
Yeah, I mean, the laws in this, they do not have, I think, the capacity to deal with the complexity that we're dealing with. I mean, if you think about these global things, social media has become something that empowers an enabler of all kinds of things. And it's from the devastation in Myanmar to the Arab Spring, right? So, you know, both good and bad things have happened empowered by social media. And so the question is, you know, how do we frame the social responsibility for these companies? You know, what should the government do? What should we do in the public sector that frames that so that most of the time it's being used in the public interest and it mitigates the risk? And then for the companies themselves, I mean, they don't exactly know how much they should do, no matter how many content moderators or, you know, how specific the rules are. You know, there's always some unanticipated situation or always some situation that, you know, it doesn't seem violent, it turns violent, or it does seem violent, or, you know, you're always sort of playing the odds.
So to be clear,
how one even decides, it's hard.
So to be clear, are you with Bob or are you with Vera on this?
You know, I just think kind of with both in a way. I think it's a very complicated situation, and I think the law has to grow up to deal with the nuance. And so Section 230, as both candidates have said, you know, is not up to this. I think we have to acknowledge that they are partial publishers, more or less. They are platforms, and there's a new hybrid designation that the law does not cover.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I'm with Bob. I think that you,
okay.
I think you're mucking around. I said mucking with an M with freedom of speech, and once you get into that. And I want to point out that in some of these countries like China and other places, the last thing they want is a free, internet or social media. I think Bob's right. I think either you're for...
But even freedom of speech doesn't extend to all speech. I mean, we have a designation for hate speech. You know,
I agree.
Look at, you know, slander and libel and all of that stuff in this country, and we have laws about it.
Sure. You're right.
Let me toss this at everybody. Remember when we tried to put filters on the internet and public libraries so people could go and watch pornography?
Right.
remember what happened though? It started to block sites for like breast cancer, for medical sites. It started to block so much more. And I think that's what my concern is that this is going to lead to the potential for significant secondary and tertiary problems that have not been clearly thought out.
So Bob, your point of view is that Section 230 should remain as written?
I do. And I'll take it a step further, though, is that I think there needs to be a substantive look at a number of different laws because technology and approaches have changed so significantly. Our laws have not caught up with how our modern communities are operating. And you see it in everything from the situation we're talking about right now to going back to FISA and wiretapping. It's a problem of making sure that we're updating our laws.
I so agree, and there's okay. Especially sad because there's a bunch of laws in Congress that are just sitting there. Things about data privacy, things about surveillance, things about face recognition, they're going nowhere. Sorry, Vera.
No, I also wanted to say, I agree with you, but in a broader perspective, I also wanted to say what is essential to think about is that the United States alone will not be able to decide what happens. Because once European countries agree to certain privacy laws or certain management approaches to social media companies, it affects how the United States can operate. So this is not a decision or a law that is solely based in the United States. I just want to remind everyone that historical experiences shape your outlook, right? So as a German citizen, we know our definition of freedom of speech is entirely different. We cannot in Germany, for example, march around in a Nazi uniform or shout certain things that neo-Nazis do in this country on a regular basis. That is not permitted. It is punishable under law, right? And so what we have to think about is who has so far been not protected by these kinds of sections and laws in the United States who are frequently targeted by supposed freedom of speech that is now crossing into hate speech, right? So we have to begin to think about privacy issues, protections for people, reflect on how and what can be said without just simply saying it is freedom of speech, because there are some limits and those limits have to be clearly defined, more clearly in this country. I find it repulsive sometimes what is protected in this country under freedom of speech, I must say.
All right.
But at the same time, final thought, I don't want our policies to mimic what Russia and China are doing. I mean, our freedoms have been sort of the setting standards for both our country and the world. And I think we need to continue to protect that.
Or even in post-Nazi Germany.
But our protections could be more like the General Data Protection Regulation, which is in Europe, which protects individuals, which protects their data, which gives them many more protections. And in the United States, the only state that has anything anywhere near that, and it's not exactly near that, is California, with the California Consumer Protection law. And so, we're not there yet.
We have to go. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but my thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Bob
sir.
And Vera. And Fran, wasn't
thank
that fun?
Oh, my
we
God,
missed you.
So much fun. Thank you, you guys.
All right. We'll be back right after this.